Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 223 for comics originally released on November 16th, 2011. Now, starting us off in DC is My Greatest Adventure number 2. Having gone through pretty much all of the number ones and whatnot, we figured, hey, there's a miniseries going out. Let's talk about this some. This is a follow-on to, what was the one, the six-issue miniseries they did a while back, Weird Worlds?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Weird Worlds.
We've got Garbage Man again, Tanga again, replacing Lobo as Robot Man.
Yeah.
So it's an anthology book, three very, you know, separate stories in here. And I'm liking what I'm reading, but I don't think I've ever been a huge fan lately. Back in the day, I kind of was, but lately with the multiple story, the anthology format really is what it comes down to. You know, it never bothered me back in Superman Family, in some of the stuff back in the 80s, but you got more done in one, more complete stories. They were just faster and shorter stories. Whereas here, overall, a lot of the things that didn't work for me here was just kind of when the story gets rolling, it's over.
What was interesting to me was I read the first issue of this back whenever it was, you know, it was a month ago, I guess. And I remember liking the Robot Man story. But when I started reading this installment, I had no memory of any of the specifics of the Robot Man story, and I was kind of picking it up as I went along.
That's part of the problem I'm having with this format is, I had it also with the Tanga story here, is they don't really have the space to kind of reestablish the scene. And some creators are able to do that just instantly, kind of get off on a strong moment and get back in on that same moment a month later, almost seamlessly. But it can be hard to do. And in this case, you're right. You know, I understood what was going on with Robot Man, but it's like, now what led up to this again? And with only, 10 pages or whatever per story here, they don't have the space to waste. And I liked the Robot Man story. I thought there were a couple of things, just as far as a sci-fi kind of a thing, were interesting. At first, I was thinking, it's a little odd that Robot Man's body has, like, this programming that's distinct from him. But I guess that kind of makes sense. It's sort of like the autonomic body functions, you know, your heart beating and stuff like that you don't have to consciously think about. So it makes sense, but I'd never really thought about it, so it seemed a little strange at first. But it also, this installment really underscores just how radically different and, frankly, much more impressive this robot body is than the one he previously had before Flashpoint. And this is still Cliff Steele. Seems like he still got into the same sort of a racing accident that led to him becoming Robot Man. There's no mention of the Doom Patrol at all, which isn't a problem, but does, you know, seem a little odd to me. And again, I like the story we get here, but then it's like, okay, it gets rolling, and it's time for the next story to start up, because we're done with this one.
Yeah, I liked the part where, apparently, kind of like Doc Brown's Mr. Fusion reactor from Back to the Future, it's just like any kind of matter you stuff into this thing is converted to energy and powers Robot Man. But this raises the general question that I have in most of these comics when I think too hard about it. You know, this was like when Barbara Gordon was in the wheelchair for all those years. Yeah. And it's like you got Cyborg and you got, you know, or, you know, all these people, you know, like Flash Thompson over at Marvel doesn't have the legs. Yet you have Misty Knight running around with a cyborg arm on her.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like this stuff exists in the universe. Why is it not, you know, used that much? And, you know, here, I guess kind of like Tony Stark's arc reactor, which they're finally, you know, Stark Resilient is making cars with them and stuff. It's like, if they've actually got this thing that you can, like, just toss some garbage into and, you know, you're powering this, you know, robot to, you know, fly and stuff, you know, you should be using that in, you know, should be more practical applications to this thing, you know?
Yeah, whoever invented that should be, you know, rich, and they would be rich because they sold it. Whoever they sold it to ought to be using it. I mean, even if you were to claim, well, it was the oil industry and they didn't want that getting out because it put them out of business, be that as it may, they would still use that sort of thing to go dig for the oil. You know what I mean? In the fact that, yeah, it's not been commoditized, commercialized, or whatever. It's like the old thing. You've got these guys, the villains, creating this really expensive weaponry and armor so they can go rob a bank and get about half the value of what they sunk into their weaponry and stuff.
Right.
It's like,
yeah.
Where's the logic in that?
But, I mean, I like the story. I mean, it just, it's a little harder to get into. I think all of these are good stories. My favorite is still Tonga. But, you know, if you don't like the anthology format, I would really encourage, when this is over, I'm going to guess that they're going to put out a Tonga trade paperback. That's the whole 12-part story, the 6 parts from My Greatest Adventure and the 6 parts from Weird Worlds. You know, that's 120 pages of story. You know, that's one nice, you know, trade paperback. And, you know, it'll be a great story. And the same thing with Garbage Man. And, you know, it'll be a little thinner, you know, to get the Robot Man thing, because it's going to, if it actually ends in this series, it'll be a 60-page story.
But they could pair it up with the Lobo one and just do it as like a flip book trade or something if they needed to.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, the Garbage Man stuff, I'm enjoying. I've been a huge fan of Aaron Lopresti for years and stuff. I know he really likes kind of the horror genre, and this is really, you know, kind of in his wheelhouse or whatever. And he's doing a terrific job with this. It's evocative, but not a derivative of something like Swamp Thing or what he did over on Sludge over at the Ultraverse and stuff. He's got a really great art style. He's doing a great job on the story here. And personally, what I like, and I'm not sure that everyone would like it, but what really works for me, is it's kind of a lighter spin on the horror supernatural genre. There are aspects of this that are almost classic horror things. He becomes a monster, all that kind of stuff, but it's not a horror title. It's a superhero take on it, almost. Not that Garbage Man is a superhero, he's not, but it's more like the early pre-Vertigo days of Swamp Thing versus the later Deep in the Vertigo Animal Man type stuff, or Doom Patrol, or you know what I mean, where it's just really out there. And for me, this really works. I like it where it's more tragic than creepy, and the use of Batman here was really well done and fun. I really enjoyed this.
No, I think Batman got integrated into the story in a way that made sense and worked really well.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And this is one that I felt it was a fairly satisfying chunk of story.
Yeah, it was good. And, you know, this is a really solid anthology book, because, you know, Weird World's same way. I mean, I'm not the hugest Lobo fan in the world, but it was an okay Lobo story. And a lot of times I'll read an anthology book and I really will kind of actively not care for about half the things in it. And that, you know, your chances go higher when you have more and more things. With only 3 stories in there, the fact that I'm liking all 3 of them to one degree or another is a good thing.
Well, I think a lot of that goes down to they're obviously very different stories, the 3 of them, but the art quality is consistent, even if the style is different. It's not like you're suddenly getting something that feels like it was scribbled next to photorealistic type stuff. And that jarring kind of a thing that I've seen in other anthologies. You know, everything is again, consistent quality, that it's not jarring when you switch stories of, oh crap, suddenly the plot just went away, the dialogue went atrocious, or the art's so much better or worse, or whatever. It's okay, we're just shifting to another story. It's still good stuff. And whoever, you know, kind of determined these were going to be the ones they paired together did a really good job. You know, again, we've got a little more sci-fi with Robot Man and Tonga, a little more of the horror supernatural with Garbage Man, but not to a jarring and alien degree. Whereas other times it seems like the anthology stuff, it's like, well, this is what we had, so let's just kind of cram it all together under the covers of one book and see how it does.
Yeah.
Now, the Tonga stuff I really loved. Big fan of Kevin Maguire, of course. Love his art. He's doing a great job on the story. But this is one where I really wanted to get more specifically of this one in this installment than the other two, because it really kind of felt like we only got a single scene here. It was a really good scene. I really liked it. But the size of the story dose per issue here is kind of leaving me wanting, both in some ways good and some ways bad, mainly good. But I think if they were to collect all of this, like you said, into a single trade, it would be a lot stronger there than I think the slower, not slower, it's coming out on a regular basis. There's not that much wait between issues, even if you count in the delay, or not the delay, but the pause between the two miniseries. But while that delay is standard, the story size is smaller than average, therefore, it's a little harder to get back into the story.
Right.
That's the issue I have with this, and given that aspect, while I felt the pages were used well, it did feel a little more decompressed than I think, an 8 or 10 page story every month, warranted. Specifically when she's out in space or whatever there for a little bit.
Yeah, I think that was done for dramatic effect. I can see your point, though. I don't know if you notice it or not, but what McGuire does here is he's telling the story in kind of like widescreen format. It's all the panels are, he does 4 panels per page, unless he's doing a splash page or a spread. And it's just each one is like a film,
Well, and those two pages where she's out in space and stuff pretty much had to be done that way, because it really gave the sense of, okay, she just needed a moment, this sort of a thing needs to happen. It gave the correct flow of time, but it's in such a, it takes so much of the available pages for this story installment to be both really good and really frustrating at the same time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I would have been perfectly happy if any one of these stories had filled up the entire issue. This is the one I think would have benefited the most from that. But if it gives McGuire time to be giving us stuff on a regular basis versus trying to do a monthly book and whatever, hey, I'll take what I can get when I can get it. This is good stuff.
Mm-hmm. No, very good. I mean, I give this a 4 out of 5. I mean, it's one of the better run anthologies that I've seen.
Yeah, same here. Definitely 4 out of 5. And I recommend people check out these properties when they get traded. And I hope that with like Garbage Man and Tenga, they do single trades of all of it for those characters.
Next up, we've got Avengers Academy, number 22. Got some irritating X-Men Regenesis business going on here. But this wasn't too invasive. I didn't feel like I needed to read X-Men Regenesis at all. It's got the Regenesis logo on it.
Yeah, it's got the Shadows Heroes logo on it, too. It's got far too many logos on it.
Basically, last issue, Yocasta got destroyed or killed, whatever. I'm not convinced that she's actually dead because, as Hank Pym himself says here, she's a machine. There should be some backup or trace or something of her somewhere. And I'm sure they're going to find some backup at some point. Allegedly, that was all wiped out. But, it seems like there would be a backup somewhere.
Given how often these living people in this universe come back to life, I am not surprised that there is a strong possibility that a machine could come back.
I would be really severely disappointed if she doesn't come back at some point, because everybody else gets to come back. But that's the deal. So she was quote unquote killed, and now they're trying to figure out what happened. And I'm not exactly sure how this is supposed to work, but apparently they call on the X-Men to have Magneto, who's hanging around with the X-Men, come around to use his magnetic powers to, give them some additional information. Now, here's something I wanted to ask you about, John. And it's like, I don't know if they've, because I don't read the X-Men books for the most part. I guess they've been exponentially increasing Magneto's powers for a long time, because it seems like at this point it's far beyond just being able to manipulate magnetism and metals and stuff, because the kind of stuff he's doing here is like almost like
magic.
Yeah, you know, basically it's just like, well, whatever the heck we want his powers to mean for the purpose of this story, we're going to have them be able to do. And I'm like, I didn't know Magneto could do that. So
yeah, I don't know how magnetic tachyons are, but there were a few things there that I was a little surprised by. If they continue on this direction, I expect him to expand further into the electromagnetic spectrum and actually do holograms and stuff. You know, it was a little, I don't say over the top, but this is the kind of power escalation that leads to madness. I read issue 21 right before reading this, because I knew we were going to do this issue for this episode, so a week or two back when that came out, because they were double shipping, it's like, okay, I'll just hold off. So I read the two, like I said, back to back. And there are a couple of things here with the new characters and really the new direction on this title that I'm really kind of digging and think that they're doing some fun stuff. We've got White Tiger, which, if I've got this right, this new White Tiger, who was first introduced last issue, is the aunt of the one that was in Daredevil. Because that White Tiger, Angela del Toro, was the niece of Hector Alea, or whatever, who was one of the Sons of the Tiger. And this is his sister, presumably younger sister, I don't know. But it's like, okay, White Tiger's a cool character, this is a new one, that's fun. But this series is now what I would really consider a classic Grunewaldian series, referencing Mark Grunewald, former editor-in-chief and longtime writer at Marvel, who would take characters just that had been in limbo and just kind of use them again. Maybe not majorly, sometimes only for an issue or whatever, but man, they're pulling out all the stops here. I had expected your first question to be, when Magneto first arrives, what the heck's that Sentinel doing there in the background?
I just rolled with it. I figured they...
There was a Sentinel...
Reprogrammed a Sentinel, and...
They
that
did,
was,
and that kid...
That was their pet Sentinel.
The kid sitting on it did that. That was from the 12-issue or so Sentinel series from many, many years back.
Oh, I guess I didn't realize it was from that long ago, but I went with that. Just figured, okay, they've got a Sentinel.
But I mean, they're pulling characters out of left field. Whiz Kid from the Exterminators, that's a character that goes way back that I really never expected to see again. It frankly would have been okay not seeing again. You know, so you combine some of that stuff, which is fun.
More applicably, I didn't understand why the kid with the Sentinel was there at all. I mean, they came in the Blackbird. Obviously, this Sentinel, or maybe not so obviously, unless it can like shrink up into a cube or something. I would imagine that this giant Sentinel was not in the Blackbird. So is this like kid flying along on the Sentinel's back?
No,
he didn't.
He's a member of the Academy.
Oh, is he? Okay.
That's my point. Is the Avengers Academy has taken in all comers. Whiz Kid has joined up.
I guess I missed that part.
That was in the previous issue.
Okay.
Where they open on a scene of, you know, a pool scene, and they've got the Sentinel there. They've got the new younger She-Hulk.
I guess he didn't have too many lines or something.
He had none.
I remember the main players, you know, from that, and they haven't given him a lot of characterization.
Again, these were his lines in this episode.
Okay.
Actually, the Sentinel had lines. He didn't. But, I mean, we've got Spider-Girl, we've got Teen Machine Man, or Machine Teen, or whatever it was, Rocket Racer, Ricochet, Power Man, a couple others that really, again, have been pulled out of left field for this. And it's kind of cool that they're filling the Academy now with more than just a handful of students, and a lot of these are ones that we've actually seen before. So I'm really liking that. I like when they don't feel the need to go create a bunch of new, you know, extraneous third, you know, 38th string characters or whatever. When they've got plenty, they can do it with, you know. So that was fun. I was a little taken aback by Hawkeye's look in this issue. It was ultimate.
Yeah, I didn't like the glasses. I was wondering if that was like hearkening back to those special glasses he was wearing when he was going blind, but I thought they cured him of that.
Yeah.
I didn't read all of those series, but I thought that he had been cured of the blindness. I kind of like his old mask with the little pointy things on it. And he didn't look good here. I did notice that.
Again, I think they were directly playing towards how he looked in the movie. And by the movie, I mean actually the Thor movie, not the Avengers movie that hasn't come out yet, but he'll be in there too, by probably about the time this hits trade. So, I mean, it's clear they're playing up to that. I liked how Magneto really brought up some very good points about Quicksilver's actions over the last couple of years and stuff, of how, you know, the Tarragon Mist stuff played out, stuff from House of M. So it actually shows a thing by the writers of knowing the Marvel backstory. And granted, some of this is only from the last, you know, 5-10 years, but it was the relevant stuff and it was well used.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is continuity in a good way. So we get all of that kind of great character interaction between those two, and then fight! It's like, okay, everybody gotta go slug it out or whatever. It's like, come on. You know, it's like, I know we need some action, but that just seemed a little out of, I don't say out of left field, but...
Well, it wasn't out of left field at all. I mean, it was standard superhero formula. You gotta have a fight. When hero groups get together, there's some misunderstanding or something, and then they like
somebody sneezes, everybody
whoop on
shoots
each other for a while, and then they go, "Oh, well, we shouldn't be doing that."
Yeah,
I thought it was a little over the top, and I thought Christos Gage like took his whatever part of his brain was wired for some amount of restraint and just like totally threw it out the window with the Emma Frost and Tigra thing, where, you know, she's like just making these comments all the time about, you know, you could dress up in lingerie. Don't let anybody tell you that's not an appropriate mode of dress for a teacher, you know. And then like she's in the one that really got me was when she says, "Well said, my scantily clad sister." You know, it's like
that
what?
Was that felt what? Out of character. Yeah,
that just seemed like okay.
There were aspects of the story that I thought were very well written and other aspects I thought were very not. Overall, I thought it was good, and there were a couple of places where I don't know if Christos Gage was maybe a little rushed or just didn't have a better idea or is setting something up bigger. Because I think things like that Tachyon comment that Magneto made very much played into the reveal at the end of the last issue. And really, it was about the only thing that really played into the reveal at the end of the last issue. But that issue was setting up, presumably, the beginning of a 6-issue arc that we're now in the second part of. I thought there was plenty of story, plenty of plot, plenty of conflict, even if a little of it was a little, kind of, again, the cliche, the heroes meet, they must fight. But I enjoyed the issue, and I felt it delivered a satisfying chunk of story. This is something that I think this is a title to be keeping an eye on, and if you're looking to see some obscure characters from yesteryear, maybe only showing up in the background, but at least showing up in the background, this is a good title for that. So for me, it's a 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I mean, a low 4 out of 5 for me because there were some groan-inducing parts to it. But it is a generally much stronger series. I think that shoehorning the X-Men into this issue kind of knocked it down a notch than, you know, how it normally is.
I can see that. There does seem to be a case where there were certain decisions again here that just didn't make sense.
And I'm curious as to whether this was Christos Gage saying, "Wow, I really want to bring the X-Men into this issue," versus somebody telling Christos Gage he needed to put the X-Men into this issue.
The other thing I'm curious along those lines of okay, who's responsible for this? And to me, this is between Christos Gage, the artist, and I guess Sean Chen, the penciler. But in that opening basketball sequence, when Reptile turns into what looks like a woolly mammoth.
Yeah.
Reptile.
Yeah, I looked at that and it's like, well, he could turn into dinosaurs. And now, I mean, a mammoth is not even in the same epoch as dinosaurs.
Or even, you know, remotely reptilian looking.
He's not the same, you know, genus or anything like that. And it's just, I was curious about that one too.
Yeah.
It's just like, is now he can like pretty much, he's Beast Boy and he can turn into any kind of animal. He's like, I mean, if you can turn into a woolly mammoth instead of just a dinosaur, I don't know why you can't turn into an elephant or a
Yeah.
eagle or, you know, whatever the heck you want to.
I'm wondering if this also ties into the revelation at the end of the last issue. But, you know, we'll see how that plays out in the upcoming four issues or more.
But this is the only Avengers book I'm getting anymore, so...
I can understand that. It's actually a really good book. You know, again, I like how they've got a wide canvas they're dealing with and a ton of characters they can draw on. We'll see how well that works for them, or if they get kind of labeled as the, ooh, there's too many characters, it's too confusing.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And then our last one is Morning Glories, number
14.
This is an interesting series because it goes to show that, I mean, a lot of times when a story is written and there's really no resolution to anything and it just kind of strings you along and no actual clarity on what's going on, that's a negative for me, you know, mm-hmm. And we will use that as a criticism point as why we didn't enjoy something. And this series flies in the face of that because it goes to show that you can do that. And if you do it elegantly, or at least the way that Nick Spencer is doing it in this series, I don't mind it at all.
Well, it's one of those where this is a mystery story of I'm trying to think of how to correctly phrase this, of what's going on, not what the heck just happened. There are some stories I've read where the mystery is what story were they trying to tell? To me, this is a great series. It lives up to its initial hype line pitch line of Lost meets the Runaways. I don't know about the Runaways part, but this is very evocative, structurally, storytelling-wise and stuff, to Lost for me, and I mean the higher points of that TV series. And I'll admit, some issues of this title work a lot better for me than others. And usually the ones that don't work as well for me are, I think, because I'm just out of the rhythm of the story. This is not a surface-level story. There are things that I think if I were to go back and reread issues, I would pick up stuff that I missed the first time. And I think going through it that first time, I realized I was missing stuff, maybe not specifically what. And this issue made me actually want to go back and find the previous one, although I couldn't get my hands on it fast enough, because there were aspects or scenes here where we're seeing some of the same stuff from another character's perspective. In this case, it was the two characters bumping each other into each other in the hallway and some of the stuff that goes on after that. And it's one of those where I'm willing to bet if I were to compare the scenes page by page, they'd line up pretty much perfectly in sync, not like the how did somebody die in some of the Marvel events where, depending which book you look at, it's fairly different. There's a cohesiveness here, and I like the more's going on at any one time than we can show you it at any one time, if you will. Again, going back to kind of the season 2 opener of Lost, where those first 3 episodes or so seem to all take place concurrently, and peel back the onion layers as different people's perspective and what's happening with them get factored in. And then you hear a noise in the background and realize, oh, wait, we saw so-and-so do that last week when these events were playing out. And that's done just beautifully here, and I'm really liking that. And I'm also thinking that, to a degree, this is just a deeper story than I can always follow in the monthly format. And that's a failing on me, not on Spencer and the artist here, because I think Nick Spencer is playing fair. He's not obscuring stuff for the sake of obscuring things. He is telling a complex but not convoluted story. And it's going to take a while for the big picture and everything to really play out. But at this point, I've got a lot of faith that it's going to play out and it's going to pay off. So I'm really enjoying the ride on this story, even if I know I'm not catching all the subtleties, all the scenery and all of the plot points that are happening.
Yeah, I mean, this is a book that, I don't know, I mean, the way that the trades are going so far, it's not like you're going to get the end of the mystery in the first trade or the second trade. I mean, we're up to issue 14 and there's still a lot of stuff, you know, almost everything that we don't know. I mean, they're filling in lots of characterization. They're filling in little breadcrumbs here and there. but I mean, this is set up to be going on a good long time, because realistically, it's kind of like Lost in that respect. I mean, once you solve the mystery, the series is over. You know, there's not a lot, you know, to do, you know, going forward from there. So if he wants to run this for, you know, 60 issues or 100 issues or however long Nick Spencer wants to run this for, you can't let those final revelations out until you get near the end.
Agreed, but I think part of the brilliance of how he started the story is we know something's going on. At this point, I'm not even sure we know the right questions to ask to get kind of whatever that final answer is going to be. Whereas with some shows like Lost, of what the heck's going on with this island, are sometimes obvious up front. Other shows, I'm going to use Monk as an example of who killed his wife Trudy. You know, that's something that plays out over the course of the 8 seasons, but sometimes so far and invisibly in the background as to be a non-issue. It was more of a premise thing than a part and parcel of the body of the series. Whereas here, we're getting, like you said, those breadcrumbs and stuff, and I feel that we're getting enough of those every issue. It's not like, oh, this is an arc issue and the rest aren't or something. And I feel like we're slowly making that progress, and it's fun to explore that, and I feel like he's not just replacing one question with another. He's giving
He gives you certain significant facts each issue.
Yeah.
Right? Like the fact here that, like, Miss Hodge and this other one, Miss Darabont,
mm-hmm.
are sisters.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, okay, well, that's interesting. And, you know, their father is apparently the headmaster.
Well, but it comes down to the underlying question, but what does that mean?
No, I'm not
which
saying
I
it,
like.
Yeah, I'm not saying it means anything. I'm just saying that you've got this piece of information now, and the fact that you got that piece of information is somehow satisfying, right? So you're forgiving the fact, you know, that you don't feel like you're just completely out, you know, floating in the ether here, because there's these little tidbits that are, you know, tossed out to you each issue. You get extra little pieces, and, you know, some of them fit together, and, you know, it's like you're putting a puzzle together. You know, it's like sometimes you'll get like two pieces and they'll fit together, but you don't know where those two pieces go. So you set them aside, you know, and you just start putting the thing together piece by piece. And all these little things, as you, you know, fit more and more together, then you're getting bigger blocks. And then at some point you're going to fit two of those bigger blocks together. And it's like, ah, that's a horse, you know, or something.
Sooner or later it hits that critical mass and more things start to click into place. What's also nice is the basic what's going on question that we have is pretty much the same question that the students here have. Now, we may have a lot more information than they do, just because we're seeing events they don't. But it's I like that there's not, again, that one hook question that, well, if that's answered, then series over. You know, there's like you said, this is something that could easily go for 100 issues or more. And I certainly hope it gets a chance to play out for whatever Spencer has envisioned here. And I really hope Nick Spencer has a game plan. I'm certainly under the impression he's got one. If he's just making this up as he goes along, I would both be very, very surprised and frankly a little disappointed, because I want it to pay off very well at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say that Joe Isima on the art, and I apologize if I'm butchering the name, is just doing a fantastic job. It's nice, clean art. There's a definite sense of, you know, background solidity and cohesiveness to this environment, and it makes the story feel all the more real.
Yeah, I will point out that the covers by Rodin Escuejo are fabulous as well.
And yeah, they are.
He's actually doing, I forget when I saw it, but I saw some solicit, or maybe it was in one of the cons where Image was talking about stuff coming out next year. He's actually doing the interior art on a series that's coming up in 2012, but I'll really look forward to that. See if, you know, the level of quality that he's bringing to these covers is, you know, he can carry out a whole issue of sequential storytelling. I usually wonder that. You know, it's like some of these guys that do really great cover images. How they do? How would they do doing a whole page of a sequential?
Yeah. No, because
page and issue.
I'm loving the covers and stuff. I think this is just a very striking one. And I agree. Can they do the storytelling versus just a really nice static shot or whatever? But I would definitely be interested in checking out a comic where this guy has done the sequential stuff.
Well, that's why I like this cover, because this cover is not just it's more of like, you know, it's an overhead shot. They're running in the forest. You know, a lot of the other covers have been kind of more static pose kind of things.
There's an aspect of the coloring, the line work, and the figures here that if I were to find out that this guy was using computer-generated art either as a basis or for actual some of the content of this, I would not be surprised. Regardless of what tools he's using, either, you know, some three-dimensional CG work or if it's all by hand, it's great stuff. And, you know, I like that not only is it a really strong cover, it's similar enough in style to the interior art that you don't feel kind of like a bait-and-a-switch thing either.
Right.
But it gives it a nice, strong cover to stand out on the rack, which I mean, it certainly draws my eye, and I read tons of comics. I would think it would do that for other people. So this is a series that I really recommend. And, again, I'll admit there have been some issues that have worked great for me, others not so much. This is one that when it's all said and done, I'd like to be able to find the time and read through the whole thing again. And having both it all in kind of that compressed time frame for reading and with the hindsight of knowing kind of how things eventually pay off or whatever, how it all looks to me at that point.
Yeah, this is a book that, you know, I was thinking about what would I rate this, and it does stand above, you know, because I just gave a 4 out of 5 to Avengers Academy and a 4 out of 5 to My Greatest Adventure. And this is better than both of those. You know, it's like I got to give this a 5 out of 5. It stands above most of the books that I read.
I would agree with that.
It's in that top 10% easily of the stuff that I read.
I would definitely agree with that. They're telling both a different genre of story, a different level and depth of story here. To me, it's a 5 out of 5. The comment I'm going to make with that, not to say it's a caveat, but if you're looking for something that's a surface-level read, this isn't that. If you're looking for something that actually has some depth and something to ponder about and figure out what is going on behind the scenes, what's the deeper story and stuff, this is totally the book for you.
I'll give a caveat to that, though, because, you know, while it has depth, the surface read is enjoyable also, and the depth is not. I mean, because I mean, I read some of these comic series, notably when Grant Morrison's in a particularly cryptic mood, you know, where there's a lot of, you know, depth to the thing, but it's like you're really got to be, you know, Ellery Queen to ferret out, you know, what the heck is going on in the story. And I don't feel that way when I'm reading this.
I agree. I guess for me, those Grant Morrison stories, Final Crisis being a good example, to me, that's like a surface level story, but you're the rock that's skipping across the surface and missing large chunks of it. Because I feel he's leaving out aspects of the story. Whereas here, it's all there, but not all of it is immediately obvious because, like you said, there's that really good surface level story, but there's the, oh wait, this is really some of the other stuff, the pieces you've got to kind of fit together to really catch more of what's going on than is immediately obvious.
Yeah. I mean, this is an exceptionally well done story. So, and I also will say that I think that Nick Spencer's work on this series is head and shoulders above, you know, a lot of the Marvel stuff. I like Iron, you know, the War Machine stuff just fine, but there's so much more here than in that story. Maybe it's just because he owns this, you know?
Well, this has the potential of being his Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Of something that, you know, once more people really get into it and whatnot, kind of gets that word of mouth, kind of gets that momentum behind it sales-wise and whatnot, could easily be turned into a successful TV series or series of movies or whatever. which would give it even a bigger spotlight and whatnot, and it's got the substance to merit that. I think his other work, like you said, the Iron Man 2.0 with the War Machine stuff, even his work on Supergirl, on Thunder Agents over at DC and whatnot, is all very good, very solid, I would say above average. This is better than that.
Right. And I would say that the Thunder Agents was better than, you know, the Iron Man also, but this is better even than that. But it's taste too, you know, because I've talked to people who've read this and they just don't care for it. So, you know, it's like your mileage may vary, I guess is the bottom line.
To me, that's a matter of depth, because sometimes I'm one of those people that for certain issues, it's like, I don't know, you know, because I'm not getting into the story to the depth I need to really pull that out. I guess the other question that you raised, though, is between the creator-owned and the work-for-hire type stuff, how much of a factor is kind of his commitment? The other question, though, that comes with that is how much of it is with this, he can do whatever he pleases. Whereas, you know, in that Iron Man 2.0, oh, wait, we've got to stop for fear itself. Oh, wait, we've got to do this.
And I'm not implying that he's, like, holding back necessarily on a Marvel thing. It's just that there are constraints just by nature of the fact that you're going through Marvel editorial and you don't own it, and you have to, again, you know, like he got his entire storyline interrupted by, you know, Fear Itself for 3 issues and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Well, that doesn't happen when he's completely in the driver's seat telling his story here.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's fun that he gets to play with some of the toys at the big companies too.
So. Yeah. Okay. Well,
That's pretty much all I've got so far, because I haven't read anything else. I've got about another nearly 4 dozen books. Big shipping week for me. I got a total of like 51 items, one of which was that free Legion Flight Ring that finally came. It was supposed to come with the Legion Secret Origins we reviewed. Wow, that was actually it was 2-3 weeks ago, I guess, we reviewed it. Nice ring. On par with the Flash Ring, not quite as spiffy as the power rings and whatnot. But yeah, there's just a ton of stuff coming out, and I seem to be getting most of it.
I read a couple of things. I read The Walking Dead, 91 that came out. That one's always, you know, the first thing I pull out of a box and read. And, you know, standard high quality thing. Got more stuff going by. You know, ends on a note of, how's that going to play out? You know, it's just solid, good overall issue.
I want to touch on that comment for a minute. I like when issues end on that, how's that going to play out, or the, wow, that's interesting reveal or whatever, and give food for thought to ponder and speculate about, versus those that end on the dun-dun-dun cliffhanger kind of a thing.
Yeah, and this wasn't a cliffhanger, you know, at all. It was more of a food for thought kind of a thing, you know, which Kirkman sometimes will have the cliffhanger, like that time when like the governor's like coming up with the big army of dudes from that town, you know, storming the prison, you know, that's kind of a cliffhanger. But this was more of a subtle one. The other one I read was Atomic Robo, Ghost of Station X number 3, another superb issue of that series. You know, it's like when there's certain of these series that I love so much that, you know, they're kind of go-to. I mean, there was a lot of good books in this week's shipment.
Yeah, there were. I'm looking forward to both the ones you just mentioned, particularly that Atomic Robo. The guys at Red 5 just knock that out of the park every time. That's very much become kind of their cornerstone book, just de facto.
Yeah. And I also read Blue Beetle number 3. It was one of the ones that I had originally pulled the plug on, of the New 52. And as I read it, I really liked that issue. You know, it was the last one I had pre-ordered, and I'm going back and adding it back to my pull list on the strength of the 3rd issue. So it has come back from the, you know, jaws of cancellation off of my pull list and is back on.
Well, I haven't read that issue yet, but my take on that title is it's the one that's kind of benefited the most from getting essentially a do-over, if you will, and it's kind of maybe a harsh term, but what I mean is, they're taking a look. It seemed like they took a look at what worked really well in that last series they did, emphasizing the strong points, downplaying the parts that weren't as strong or whatever, retooling the story and kind of giving it a kind of a 2.0 pass or whatever phrase you want to use. and really benefiting from that. Mm-hmm. I thought the first issue of that was much stronger than the first issue of the previous run, and they're covering similar but not identical ground. So I'm glad to see that one stayed on or made it back onto your list.
Good series.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for me.
Awesome.
Join us next week when we discuss Green Lantern, The New Guardians, number 3 from DC, Fantastic Four, number 600 from Marvel, and Rachelle Mead's Dark Swan, number 4 from Sea Lion Books.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.